Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. So later on in the program, we are going to be speaking with Kathy Scott. She's the author of the new book, Paw Prints of Katrina, Pets Saved and Lessons Learned, with a foreword by Allie McGraw. She will be with us in just a little while. And we're also going to be speaking at the end of the show to a couple of the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Right now, I would like to welcome, joining us here in the cafe, Marianne Redding. She is the curator of the photo archives at the Palace of the Governors and the New Mexico History Museum, and Krista Elrick, who is the co-curator, along with Marianne Redding, of the exhibit Through the Lens, Creating Santa Fe, which opens tomorrow, Friday, at the Palace of the Governors. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is an amazing exhibition of photographs, hundreds of photographs of all types and throughout over, 150 years or so?
160.
160 years. And this is photographs through the lens, creating Santa Fe. What, first of all, do we mean by Santa Fe?
Well,
do we mean the city? I mean the...
Well, that's something actually that we talked about for a long time. It was one of the first questions we had to answer. How do you define the boundaries of Santa Fe? Because the boundaries have changed over time. So what we did was look at the city as it exists today. We looked at the historical routes into Santa Fe, La Bajada Hill, the Santa Fe Trail, and we also looked at the nearest pueblo to Santa Fe because we wanted to talk about the interaction between pueblo life and the city. And so that's Tesuque Pueblo, and we extend out to Galisteo, to Lamy, which is a little stretching it, and then to Agua Fria Village. But it's a strange map, but that's the map of Santa Fe that we've defined for this exhibition.
And one of the reasons why that definition was made was because the notion of what Santa Fe is has changed so often over time. And, of course, when the Camino Real was in full use, that trail was much more clearly defined by Santa Fe and vice versa. And then, of course...
Tell us what the Camino Real is.
The Camino Real is the trail, the roadway that goes from Mexico to Santa Fe, and was a route that really showed the trade and the migration between the north and the south of Mexico.
So you have in this exhibition all these many, many photographs, and many of them are from the archive, from your archives, mm-hmm. the photo archives that you are the curator of. This is an incredible collection all of its own.
We have in the photo archives over 800,000 images, which are from not only Santa Fe, but all of New Mexico and the Southwest, the New Mexico Territory, but we also have a European collection.
And so you went basically sorting through this gigantic thing, and it must have been amazing to make those selections.
It was a wonderful process. We not only looked at the archive at the Palace of the Governors, but Krista and the students at the Santa Fe Community College, thank you, the Santa Fe Community College, we looked at archives all across the country to look at their holdings about Santa Fe. So the collection, the exhibition that you see on the walls is from the collection of the Palace of the Governors Photo Archives, but it also includes contemporary photographers who are making place-based work in Santa Fe. We, Krista and I, did about 100 studio visits with people all around New Mexico and some out of New Mexico who have done work inside of Santa Fe about the city.
One thing about doing the research, when we did look at collections throughout the country, and what was amazing was that when we had selected particular images by particular artists that we were interested, it turns out that those images were generally at the archive. And we were fully prepared to loan and borrow from other institutions, but the Palace of the Governors archive, the photographic archives, is so rich and such a treasure that we didn't need to borrow as many as we thought we may have.
That's right.
Now, this is a non-chronological set of photographs, and it's grouped rather by theme, and the themes are place, identity, and history, which of course can't really be separated.
Right, exactly. What we didn't want to do a strict chronological history of Santa Fe visually. That's been done. We thought it would be more interesting to group the photographs by theme. However, just because one photograph is in the history section doesn't mean you can't see it through the lens of identity or place. So we took those three themes and their overlapping meanings, and we've also published a book that the Museum of New Mexico Press is publishing, and each of those themes is introduced by different authors. The text is excerpted from the book on the walls in the palace, and we talk about those themes and the overlapping meanings that the photographs have.
And let's go through those. For example, what are some emblematic photographs that illustrate the concept place?
Well, the one that comes to mind immediately is a photograph by Lee Friedlander. And it's a photograph that he took across the street from La Fonda Hotel, and it's looking at Farrell's, and it's looking at the camera shop there. And that, in a lot of ways, sums up this place. It's La Fonda, it's the street, it's looking down toward the Basilica to St. Francis, and it's about photography. So it brings all of those themes together, and it's actually the photograph that introduces place.
And when you talk about identity, again, you get into a lot of questions about identity and who is on the camera side and who is on the being photographed side, and what does that mean in terms of even the creation of identity?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The photograph that introduces identity is actually a really wonderful photograph. It was taken by Miguel Gandert, who's a photographer in Albuquerque. It's taken of the photographer Norman Moskoff, who's here in Santa Fe, and he's actually using a light meter at the Spanish Market to photograph one of the vendors. And in the background is the Palace of the Governor and the Fine Art Museum. So you have tourism, you have photographers, you have people who are artists here in Santa Fe, you have the History Museum, you have the Fine Art Museum, and it's on the plaza. So it brings all of those various aspects of Santa Fe and identity in Santa Fe together.
Now, when we talk about tourism, photography is the basis of picture postcards. And it was interesting to read in one of these essays that around the turn of the century, hundreds of thousands of picture postcards were mailed in the United States every year, far more picture postcards than there were people in the United States. And those pictures, made by photographers, often hand-colored, really define place, and especially tourist places like Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Absolutely.
There's a wonderful series in Through the Lens where you're looking at the original photograph, which is a platinum palladium print by Craycraft, and then of Tusuke Village. And then above it are two hand-colored postcards from different years where the image has been slightly altered, but you know it's from the original Craycraft photograph. And that's one of the things that Rena Swensel and Andy Lovato talk about in their essays for the book, what it means to be photographed and to have your culture in some ways become a commodity.
Likewise, we saw photographers who had gone to the Pueblos, photographed in Suzuki, and would go to a particular person that they thought looked appropriate or agreed to have been photographed, and over time this subject, this man, would be photographed over and over by different photographers in different types of styles and genres, and that shows up in the exhibition where you begin to see that there is a relationship between the subject and the photographer over the course of many, many years. And then eventually they do become postcards as well.
And then there's always this question of what is the authentic person, just the way they're living, and then what is the romanticized image, mm-hmm. if it's, say, an Indian. There's one picture of a man just in his work clothes, and then suddenly he's in an Indian blanket looking
right.
like
a... Indeed, yeah. A photograph by T. Harmon Parkhurst. And Parkhurst is one of the collections that we have in the photo archives.
Tell us more about Parkhurst.
Parkhurst actually came from the East Coast here. He was a student of Jesse Nussbaum's. Jesse Nussbaum was at the Museum of New Mexico very early on, and he taught Parkhurst. So there's a lot of similarity between the visions of the two photographers, the two artists.
Do you ever put them next to each other and then
Absolutely.
Try to guess which is which?
Well,
I mean, you know.
We know, but that would be an interesting game to play. Whose eye are you looking at through the lens, so to speak? Parkhurst actually photographed in New Mexico for nearly 50 years, from about 1910 about 40 years, I guess, from 1910 to about 1950, 1951. So his archive, his collection at the photo archives is one of the most extensive we have and the changes of Santa Fe before statehood, after statehood, after the world wars into the 1950s.
What were the subjects of his pictures?
Everything you could possibly imagine. People, architecture, landscape, you name it, he photographed it. Mm-hmm.
Now, Ansel Adams was one of the artists who was hired to take photographs of buildings by John Gommeen.
Yes.
And there were various famous photographers commissioned for this, and there they are in the show.
Absolutely. Laura Gilpin.
Parkhurst.
Dundee. Ansel Adams.
Ernie Adams.
Right, exactly. Yes. And it's just fabulous to see them as working photographers and making imagery. And especially with Ansel Adams, you begin to see his style really emerge in his early work from these architectural images. And he uses a very similar style much later on, and it's emerging early on. And it's quite wonderful to see him as a working photographer.
Another little game that I walked through the exhibition yesterday, and a game that I want to play when I go there, is the pictures are numbered, and there's a gallery guide where you can look at them, but to look at a photograph and then try to guess what year it's from, because there's so much change in Santa Fe from 160 years ago to the present, and there's also a lot that stays the same. So I was looking at one of these, I think it was a Parkhurst photograph of an adobe building in the snow, and I thought, now was that taken last winter? And it was taken in 1912.
Isn't that wonderful? Yes. And images that were made in the 20s, downtown Santa Fe. I mean, it almost looks like Chicago or any kind of urban center. And you think, that can't be Santa Fe. But it is. And our state capitol building is amazing, where before statehood, it looked like a Greek Revival classic Victorian building. And then shortly after statehood, it becomes a Pueblo Revival. And it's amazing to see those changes.
Well, that's another thing that the exhibition does, is help us see some of the historical changes, like what this place looked like before and after statehood, and why did those changes take place?
Indeed, and the photographer's role in that, because they were very involved in helping to shape the new vision and then the
city plan from 1912. I mean, all of the photographers were involved in that. Parkhurst, Nussbaum, Carlos Vieira. They all worked with Dr. Edgar Hewitt, who was the director of the Museum of New Mexico at that time, and also the city fathers, and at that time they really were fathers, really looked at and understood that it was going to be tourism that would draw people to Santa Fe after the railroad bypassed Santa Fe. And they figured that they could do that through the new unique architecture. But that was a decision that was made pre-statehood, but really came to be after statehood, because initially to get statehood, New Mexico wanted to be seen as being very similar to the rest of the country. So a lot of the buildings that were like buildings in other part of the country, after statehood was obtained, they were torn down and replaced.
So once you had the security of actually being a state, then you could be yourself more fully and not try to conform so much.
Or you could capitalize on what was unique to your area and use that to market the city and bring people here.
Right, right. More to the point. We're talking to Marianne Redding and Krista Elric, co-curators of the exhibit Through the Lens, Creating Santa Fe, which is opening tomorrow at the Palace of the Governors. Now, there are some themes of the natural history of Santa Fe, too. The land, the questions of water.
Well, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because indeed we did include those sub-themes in the exhibition, and water being one of them. And so we see some very early images, Parkhurst and Craycroft, who do photographs of the Santa Fe River. And then we begin to...
When it was really the Santa Fe River.
When it was flowing.
Free-flowing Santa Fe.
It's an interesting series, because the first photograph in that series is taken by the photographer Edward Ranney, who's here in Santa Fe. And it's an early petroglyph that shows a river and that shows people running toward the line that becomes the river. And we look at Parkhurst and Nussbaum's photographs of the Santa Fe River when it was flowing. And then we look at a photograph that Joan Myers made just recently from a helicopter looking down on the city of Santa Fe and the water tanks that were made there. We look at photographs of people drilling to 760 feet, which is fairly deep. So we're talking about water issues and the broader issues that surround that too, population, where's our drinking water coming from? Can we sustain life in Santa Fe at its current growth? All of those issues are in the photographs.
And some of them, they emerge as you talk about them. For example, there was a photograph that you and I were looking at yesterday, and I was saying, what an aesthetically beautiful picture of a mesa outside of Santa Fe. And you said, well, what this is really is an anti-development photograph, because
right.
they want to put a real estate development here.
Right, and that was a photograph that William Clift made out in the Galisteo Basin, where the new development will go in there. And it is a very political photograph. You may not necessarily see that when you first look at this beautiful landscape, as you described it, and it is a beautiful landscape, but when you start to understand the issues behind the photographs, and that's something that we've done in the exhibition, is that we've interviewed 10 of the photographers who were in the exhibition, and you can get more information about them, about their thinking, about their processes, by checking out an iPod at the front desk of the House of the Governors when you come into the museum.
So we are in the modern era in so many ways. There, mm-hmm. We have iPods, no longer the little...
flat screen TVs.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a flat screen. Well, and so there's 100, what, almost 200 pictures in hanging. And mm-hmm. I love the way they're hung all over the walls, as you say, salon style. So it's not, you know, it's sort of crowded in this wonderful way that makes you want to... go back, you know, it's a show that if you have, I mean, it's going to be up for a while, right?
Yes, it will be up for almost a year. It will be up until next October, the end of next October.
So it's really worth going to over and over again, because you can't take it all in at once. But in addition to the photographs that you chose to hang, there's even more that are being shown as kind of a slideshow on these flat screen monitors?
Mm-hmm. We have a large flat screen monitor that will have about another 100 images from Santa Fe that will rotate on a slideshow about every 15 seconds. And that was a way for us to show more of the collection from the images of Santa Fe in the exhibition.
And there's also stereo viewers, which you
yes.
can pick up and have, what is it, a kind of a 3D experience?
Exactly.
And let's see...
There are a lot of photographers photographing each other.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about.
Another theme that we really wanted to develop was how photographers really did, it's about community and how rich this area has been for so long for photographers. So we begin with early photographers who photographed themselves.
Ben
Wittick photographing himself in front of a camera, and then photographers photographing other photographers. And it really is about generations and community and just sharing each other out through imagery. And that's a theme that we really enjoyed working on with photographers, and I'm sure others will enjoy it as well.
So this is opening tomorrow. Oh, one of the things that I thought was also interesting was here you are in the Palace of the Governors, and then there's some... photographs of the interior of the Palace of the Governors when it was really a residence.
Mm-hmm. They're
looking not all that different.
No, it doesn't look that different. The photographs that you're talking about were the photographs that were made of the Prince Room when Prince was governor of New Mexico, and they are positioned right outside the Prince Room, which has been recreated based on those photographs. So you have all these different layers of history, and it shows you how photographs can be fine art, they can be documents, they can be historical references. In and of themselves, they are many different things to many different people.
You know what's nice also is that it seems like you've avoided a lot of avoided the basic Santa Fe cliches.
Good.
There's no wall of Edward Curtis Indians.
No.
Nope.
And that's very deliberate. We didn't want to do a show of one-hit wonders or a show of photographs that have been seen many, many times over and over again. We really mine the archives for images, some of which will be known, but most of them will not be. And that's also the benefit of working with contemporary photographers. Their collections are not in the photo archives, although we have had several photographers donate their archives to us at the photo archives from the show. So we did very much try not to have a show of cliches, but look at the rich visual history of Santa Fe from multiple lenses.
Generally, in the studio visits, photographers would show us initially images that were very good and strong, but were kind of along the lines of what they thought we might want to see. And the more time we spent with them asking them questions and looking in areas that they hadn't initially pulled out, that's where the richness began, and that's generally where we pulled from the images that we wanted.
And just hearing that gives us who don't know what your job is like an insight of what it really takes to be a curator of a show like this. You really have to dig.
Took 20 months in the Palace of the Governors to put together. It's a show that's inception started many years before that.
Many years, I mean, people in Santa Fe have been watching it change and grow, and particularly the faculty at the community college have been concerned about the development and changes. And so collectively there was an interest to begin to at least begin to document what the changes are going on. It began at the community college. It began in the classrooms, encouraging students to photograph and take a look and record traditions, communities, subcultures within the area. And then from there, it began to solidify into this idea that it could be an exhibition that was somehow corresponded to the 400th celebration of Santa Fe. And once it was at a point where we had an idea, a solid idea, then we, fortunately, the archive had just recently hired Marianne, and it was good to have her on board, where then we were able to, well, work together, and then her vision and professionalism and focus really helped to shape the show as it is right now. And so that's how it really began and finally ended.
It's not ending. Well, I mean, we have also with it a whole series, a lecture series, that we'll have one a month, we'll have 12 lectures. So once the show's up on the wall, that's not the end of the process. Then you have the lecture series. We've invited several people who have written for the book, various photographers, art historians, critics, to come and talk about the exhibition, talk about the book, talk about the photographs, talk about the meaning of place and what place means in Santa Fe. And the first one will be Lucy Lepard, will be our keynote speaker. She'll be speaking at Tipton Hall at the College of Santa Fe on Friday, December 5th at 6 o'clock in the evening.
This and so much more at the exhibit Through the Lens, Creating Santa Fe. It opens tomorrow, Friday, at the Palace of the Governors at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Yes.
And runs for about a year. Marianne Reddick and Krista Elric are co-curators of this fine show with an even more, equally marvelous book that goes with it. Yes. And one thing we didn't have time to talk about today, but which people really should take note of when they go see the show, is the incredible diversity of media, from cyanotypes to the very old, I don't even know what they're called.
Daguerreotypes.
Daguerreotypes to digital media and everything in between.
Right. Practically all of the processes that photography has gone through throughout its history is also in the show.
So thank you, ladies, so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Kathy Scott. She's the author of the book Paw Prints of Katrina, Pets Saved and Lessons Learned, with a foreword by Allie McGraw. And she will be speaking this Saturday, November 22nd, from 4 to 5 at Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So how did you find yourself in New Orleans shortly after Hurricane Katrina working with animals?
Well, I'm a journalist by trade, and I had contacted, I heard that Best Friends was looking for people to go down to, Best Friends Animal Society, for people to go down there. And so I sent them an email letting them know my background. I've been to war zones, Somalia, and all that. And they took me on as an embedded reporter. And I went down there for 2.5 weeks and stayed for 4 months.
You call it embedded, even when it's something which is not really military. That's funny.
Well, it was kind of a military operation. You know, when you're in a rapid response situation, it's very military-like. You've got a base camp, a command center. FEMA was in charge, sort of, at that point. It was very loose. Today, of course, because of Katrina, things are much tighter, and, you know, animals will not be forgotten again, thank goodness. But yeah, so basically that's what I was. And then they hired me afterward as a writer for their website and magazine.
So describe to us this whole process, which you describe in the book, chapter after chapter. It's I mean, both beautiful and harrowing and happy and everything, but describe of being on animal rescue duty. What was it like? What did you do?
Oh, thank you, first of all, for saying that. Well, I just, you know, I'm a reporter, so I've written other books as well, but, you know, I'm a true crime author. So it was a departure for me, but not that big of a departure since, you know, it was about investigation and that sort of thing, you know, reuniting people with their pets. But I don't know, I just sort of hit the ground running my second day I was on the water, and I actually opened the book, as you know, with that scene. It was September 11th, and I arrived on the 9th and was on the water on the 11th. And the biggest thing that hit me was sort of the silence and the fact that it was very palpable being down there and realizing that the only beings left in the area were animals. That was what struck me the most, and they were helpless. They were absolutely helpless without us. So that was why it was so important. And there were thousands of them trapped inside homes and buildings and wandering the streets without food and water.
And so there are so many descriptions of these stories, some of them so sad, of somebody tied their animals up and they drowned because their leashes weren't long enough for them to swim. But then some of them were standing on top of roofs. Some of them were going from porch to porch, sort of swimming in the water and then getting back up on a house. What did you do? You just looked for them, put them in a boat, and then brought them to the rescue place?
Yeah, we used a street as an off, you know, as a boat launch. It became our boat launch, and you know, teams were out every day. Several teams. I was with, you know, the first day out, I was with we had two boats out that day, I think, and you know, we're the only ones down there. We didn't see anybody besides some people rescue people, some human rescuers, and we just grabbed them. You know, at that point, they just come to you. They were so shell-shocked. You know, we just kind of get into the houses and reach for them, and they come to us. There was one dog that, you know, one of the guys I was with went into a house, and the dog went out the back, somehow jumped in the water, and it was very, he opened the back door first and came out the front, and then the dog ran out. He was trapped inside, and I felt badly about it at first, but we actually freed him. And there, you know, he could, not too far away, he could have found land or another porch or something, you know, to save himself. So we basically saved him, and somebody else probably got him later. As time went on, they got sort of skittish and almost feral-like, just out of fright, and became much tougher to get. You know, so it took traps and everything else. But in the water, it was a matter of just plucking them out of the houses. They come right up to you, even the cats.
There were some people who would call the animal rescue places and say, my house is in such and such a place, and there's a cat on the second floor in the bathroom, or a dog or whatever, and you go actually find it.
We did. Well, the rescue people all, you know, because I went with them and ended up, of course, you become a part of it. You know, sometimes they weren't happy endings. Because the water had gone too high. But we did get those out and reunited so many of them, 20%, which is pretty high. You know, typically shelters reunite, you know, just regular shelters, about 10%. So 20% is a really good number. Thanks to PetFinder.com.
Right.
Everybody referred to that. And, you know, Craigslist, everything. You know, people were going everywhere. Red Cross. You know, it was pretty known almost immediately who was down there, what groups were down there, and who. And, you know, people just filed in. Drove to Tylertown, Mississippi, where we had a triage center, and just filed in to look for the pets. Very sad, but happy as well. And the reunions really kept the volunteers going. Hundreds of people who you know, gave up their lives to help other people's pets. And it made everybody's day when there was a reunion.
And some of those reunions are amazing. I mean, people who were very far away and would send pictures on email to Pet Finder, and then somebody would see it and say, "Didn't I see a pet like that in a cage just a little bit while ago?" And I mean,
people sitting in their homes were reuniting. They were matching. They were cross checking, and that was huge. That was a big, big deal. We got so many emails. I mean, by the time we got internet service up, I had so many emails coming my way. It was hard to keep up, hundreds, you know, a day, and trying to match up. And many of those stories are in there. One woman sent out 200 press releases and pleas to newspapers and sites and everything else. And Best Friends, you know, the triage center I was at, had her dog, her son's dog, and reunited him. We got him out of there, out of the water, pulled him out of his house from the same neighborhood I was in that first day. He was a pit bull, a little cut up, but he just got cut up from the flooding. We thought maybe he was a fight dog. We got a lot of fighting pit bulls out of there, you know. So some of those dogs, it was the best thing that ever happened to him.
Indeed.
You know.
What were some of the kinds of health problems that the dogs had as a result of, first of all, not being rescued quickly, and second, being in a storm and water flood situation?
They were all sick. Everybody was
sick.
What
kind of sicknesses did they have?
A horrible nose. Their eyes and their noses just runny and icky. And some had mange, but, you know, some were in bad shape. You know, and there were many dogs and cats in great shape, but some were in awful shape and probably were that way earlier. But matting and the awful thing that as time went on and the water evaporated and not only evaporated but was drained out, you know, when they were, you know, as time went on, that sludge of urban sludge with everything in it became acidic and actually burned their paws off. So they were coming in with burns all over their bodies. And the upper respiratory problems, parasites, many, 90% of the dogs we got had heartworm.
So who were the veterinarians and even the groomers who came and took care of these animals? They came from far and wide.
People came from all over. Yeah, all walks. Yeah, I got down there. I think there were five vets down there, and those guys worked morning through night. It was amazing. I mean, the triage center, we call it the MASH unit, because it was very much like that, you know, just a makeshift, makeshift center. And they triaged. I mean, dogs and cats were crashing on the scene, and they, you know, they brought them back. It was amazing what, and the will to live, and just bringing them out of there and able to save them. It was amazing. We didn't worry about the ones we couldn't get. You know, it's weird when you're in a situation like that, but you sort of just work hard, and, you know, you don't worry about, you can't change the ones you couldn't save. You worry about the ones you could, you know.
There was one little animal that was caught. It was stuck in a bathtub, and somebody went into a house, and they said, "We think there's an animal in here." And they walked around. They didn't see an animal, and then they heard this very faint tapping. And with the last bit of its strength, the dog was wagging its tail against the bathtub, and it was found, and that dog lived.
Yeah, that was Shmoo, and that was on the cover of the book. That's actually Sergeant Cliff Deutsch. I'm not quite sure if he's in. He used to be in Florida. I think he's in Michigan now, but he's or Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, I don't remember where. He's a canine handler, and he couldn't believe it. He the house, the water had gone above the ceiling, and that dog was locked in a bathroom, and he heard the tap 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 and thought, "What's that?" He followed the sound, busted the door open because there's stuff everywhere. And there she was, couldn't even lift her head, but she was wagging her tail. And she was just skin and bones. She'd been in there, oh my gosh, almost 30 days. And she was one sick dog. Turned out she was a pit bull, very friendly, doesn't like other dogs. She now lives with a vet tech. Her favorite place is the sofa, and she's fine. But it took about 8 months to bring her back. A vet took her home.
Now,
it was amazing. I mean, there were so many stories like that.
Yes, exactly, and they're in your book. I mean, really, if you want to like laugh and cry and just feel, I mean, it's really a book for animal lovers. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a book for animal lovers, and it really makes you realize that animals, they are so innocent, and they're like children, and they're utterly vulnerable, especially in a situation like this. They're
totally
not
at our mercy, and they were, you know, they were, I mean, people didn't know that they were only going to be, that they weren't going to be gone for just 2 or 3 days. They thought they were helping their animals, you know, by putting them upstairs in a bathroom so they couldn't escape and go downstairs and drown, not knowing that they weren't going to be allowed back in, and, you know, for weeks and weeks. And so we just, you know, went through. We got, our best friends got about 7,000 out. Total, the estimation is around 15,000 animals. And we got 7,000 out of there, which is pretty good. And, you know, not everybody made it, but the mortality rate was not that high, you know.
Now, there were some
and
other kinds of
second generation were born out there too.
Yeah, right. There were some other kinds of animals besides just cats and dogs.
Oh gosh, we squirrel, an emu we named Big Bird, and he's actually at the Racine Zoo in Wisconsin. He's got a girlfriend and he's nesting, and he's in the largest habitat they have, and he's with kangaroos. He was a sick bird. He lived in somebody's backyard, and he wouldn't eat regular food at first because he was used to getting bread and stuff. That was actually, he's probably sick when Katrina hit, because that's not healthy for birds. So he really is in, you know, for him, Big Bird's doing well. They had to isolate him for a long time. Lizards, pigs, we got 3 pot-bellied pigs, and one had been attacked by dogs that made it. Because, you know, dogs got everybody, they were out there for months. I mean, it took months to round up a lot of them.
Well, there was this one guy whose dogs were stuck in his house, and they ripped open his vitamins, and they ate all his vitamin pills. And
yes,
that was part of how they lived.
yeah. It is amazing, really. Yeah, they did. John David or David John, he's got a florist shop in downtown New Orleans, one of his dogs was lost with one of his employees, and we had her, a chow, but his other two were at home and just hit the cupboard and were fine, and they were by themselves for a couple of weeks, I think. Smart dogs, huh?
Smart dogs indeed, and you know, the instincts run deep when they really need to.
Yeah.
The subtitle of the book is Pets Saved and Lessons Learned. What were some of the lessons learned?
I think the lesson learned is you know, that you can't leave sentient beings, you know, breathing, feeling animals alone. You have to make provisions for them, and thank goodness There have been provisions made. There are so many lessons in it. And, you know, for the people who are in the flood areas and disaster areas, fire areas, you know, don't leave your pets. And if you do, take a spray can and paint their number on the side of their bodies if they're big enough, or put a collar on them, microchip them.
Microchip them, definitely.
Very important.
It's,
you know, all of that.
You know, during
so,
that same year of, I believe it was the same year as Katrina, there was a big hurricane in Cuba, and that was a nation that let people and their pets evacuate together, and it seems so barbaric that we didn't do that.
Yeah, we didn't do it, and we'll never, you know, we'll never do that again. I mean, shortly after with Hurricane Rita, and that hit Texas hard, Texas officials allowed people to take them. I mean, what they have to do is federal. There's now a federal law, because of Katrina, that says cities, counties, states have to have a center for people and a center for animals. If you've got people evacuating, you have to make provisions for the animals. And, you know, I was very lucky. Allie McGraw lent her good name to this book, and she'll be with me at the book signing on Saturday at Garcia's. And she wrote a beautiful foreword to it and wanted to be down there, and for whatever reason didn't make it down. So she feels very connected to the story.
Kathy Scott is the author of Paw Prints of Katrina, Pets Saved and Lessons Learned. The foreword is by Allie McGraw, and they will, I guess, both be there this Saturday, November 22nd, from 4 to 5 at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. Kathy, thank you so much for being here, and we look forward to meeting you.
Thank you. And Clay Myers, the photographer, will be there as well.
Oh, and that's the one thing I forgot to mention. There's fabulous photographs in this, too, so people can take a look at it when they're there. Bye. Kathy, thanks again.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I'd like to welcome now, joining us in the cafe, part of the Santa Fe Art Institute residency program, Francisco Aragon and Melissa Oreski. And they are part of the Residence Open House, which is taking place tonight, Thursday night, at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Melissa, you are a painter, you're a visual artist, and you do what your work is what you call mental landscapes. What do you mean by that?
It's a bit complicated. It's simple and complicated, I suppose. I make a combination of abstraction, a kind of abstraction that acknowledges space and a connection to landscape. My work is really a kind of hybrid. I want it to be kind of in between a subjective experience of landscape that gets kind of reconstructed into an abstraction.
So when you make, for example, a painting or a drawing, are you in front of a landscape?
No. Never. But I go out into I go out to different places, and this year I've been doing a lot of traveling. I've been in Germany, and I've been in different places in the U.S. And I do a lot of photographing, and I always kind of think back to the memory of being in certain kinds of spaces as a starting point for different works. I also incorporate fragments of found illustrations, so biological illustrations or different scientific illustrations. Over the last few years, I've been using images of cross-sections of the brain, images of neurons, and those things are kind of transposed into these constructions to signal that they are kind of spaces to be thought of as interior landscapes rather than literal places or spaces.
And it is sometimes funny how biological imagery seems so much like some big macro landscape.
Yes.
Anyway, if you look at it from that point of view.
Yes, and I think that realizing that, kind of observing that, is what one of the things that got me onto the track of the work that I'm currently making.
So how has being in Santa Fe affected the work you're doing now?
That's a good question. I've been doing a lot of hikes, and I've also... I think that the contrast between the last place that I visited, which was... I was at a residency in the northeast of Germany, which was a very verdant kind of rolling hills, lush, low, near the Baltic Sea kind of landscape. And the contrast to coming here, which the light completely changed, the humidity, the temperature, I mean, everything
yeah,
was
it's
was
about
a huge
as different
shift.
From Germany as you can get.
Yeah.
That's why the Germans love to come here.
I've heard a few people speaking German since I've been here. At the residency, too, we have a couple of German residents at the
right,
moment.
That's right.
I've been specifically thinking about the space of the garden. And one of the things I was doing in Germany was kind of touring different gardens, different kinds of gardens, formal gardens, more English types of gardens, parks that are in cities, and thinking about how the kind of humanness of landscape and how we tend to impose boundaries on natural spaces and how the nature is always kind of pushing against those boundaries. There's this tension between those two kinds of spaces. Coming here... I think there's a slightly different, it's a different dynamic because things are more arid and because there's this sense that you want to preserve what's here rather than try to control or tame it.
You're trying to get anything to grow in the first place.
But there's, I mean, it's certainly rich. I mean, it's a rich environment. There's so much that's going on if you look at the space around you. So...
Melissa Oreski is a painter, an artist whose work is going to be seen at Open Studios of the Santa Fe Art Institute tonight at 5:30. And Francisco Aragon is an author. You are from Spain originally, is that correct?
I'm actually a native of San Francisco, but I did live in Spain for 10 years after college.
And so you're writing in English?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the work you do, and we have a book open, so I think you will read to us as well.
Well, I write primarily first-person lyric poems, and the book that I published in 2005, which is called Puerta del Sol, gathers the poems that I wrote while I lived in Spain. And I'd like to share one.
Please do.
One of the things that I did while I lived in Spain to earn my living was teach English as a foreign language to professionals in their places of work. So my daily schedule always involves me being on public transportation, going to banks, and always having to come home for a lunch break. And then in the afternoons, I would give private lessons. So this poem that I'm going to read is called Lunch Break, and it sort of tries to portray a domestic scene. The other thing I would say is my experience of living in Spain was my first time living in a country, this was in the 90s, pre-9/11, living in a country where terrorism was a distinct possibility. So this is called Lunch Break. 2 hours between classes, the short metro ride home, coffee table, plates, glasses, the TV flickering afternoon news, sometimes a car bomb. And in the kitchen, the singular tune of his voice, his jokes recounting this or that, plot of a novel, book he's put down, I bought for his monthly fix, how he'd love reading in the park what I took half an hour to choose. Above all, the sofa, digestion, a nap, my head in his lap.
A poem by Francisco Aragon. Now, this book you published is in, so that you translated that poem into Spanish as well.
Exactly, yes.
So what's your first language?
My primary, I grew up speaking English and Spanish, but of course...
So your parents were immigrants from Spain?
No, my parents were immigrants from Nicaragua.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I was schooled entirely in English, though when I got to college, I began to study Spanish formally, so I learned how to read and write it. Prior to that, I could speak it, but couldn't read it and write it. But my language of writing poetry is primarily English, but I have also done a number of works in translation as well, translated from Spanish to English.
It must have been so interesting to have your family language be one in which you couldn't read and write until later. What was that process of the formal learning of Spanish like for you?
Well, for me, it was a very practical decision because I knew when I entered college that I wanted to study abroad in a Spanish-speaking country, and I had to have 2 years of the language formally under my belt. So it was more of just a hoop that I jumped through to be able to qualify to study language, to study in Spain. What was more of a personal and interesting experience was the process of actually translating the poems that I wrote in English into Spanish. That was actually a more interesting process for me because there are a number of poems one in particular that I'm thinking of that is addressed to an extended relative who doesn't understand English. So the original poem that I wrote was actually a false poem because this person would never understand it.
So the Spanish was more authentic.
So the Spanish, in a strange way, even though it wasn't the poem's original language of composition, by my elaborating a Spanish version of it, became a more authentic piece of communication.
Do you write in Spanglish?
No, I do not.
Francisco Aragon is a writer, a poet, who is going to be reading also tomorrow night at the residency open house at the Santa Fe Art Institute. The number over there is 424-5050. It's tonight at 5:30, and you can also look at them, find them online at sfai.org. Francisco and Melissa Oreski, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month Bill Mays in the 11 a.m. hour. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Robert Knott will be here, and so much more. Keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Ciao.